If you want to write stories your readers will love, there are three things you need to do. Understand storytelling principles, see how other writers have applied those principles, and then use them in your own work. Here on the Story Nerd Podcast, our goal is to demystify story theory. We'll help you with the first two steps so that you can get started with the third. My name is Valerie Francis. I'm a writer and literary editor, and I focus on stories by, for, and about women.
And I'm Melanie Hill, writer, editor, and poet, and I have a passion for spy stories, fairy tales, and master detective novels.
On today's episode, Melanie pitched La La Land so that we can study subtext. This 2018 film was written and directed by Damien Chazelle. Of course, there's going to be spoilers because we can't talk about the movie without talking about the movie. And as always, we would love it if you could give the show a rating and review. Come on, you know you want to. For Apple Podcast listeners, you can do it right from your phone. Simply go to the show's landing page and scroll to the bottom. It really is that simple. Just click some stars and off you go. All right, Melanie. What's the genre of La La Land?
Well, this is interesting. So I had down the global genre as a courtship love story. And then I had the secondary genre I've nominated a status story because I think where the love story falls short, both protagonists succeed in achieving their original dreams. But before I ask you, Valerie, what you think the genres are, I just want to add something there about musical movies, which are said to be a dying form of storytelling, but I really disagree with that thought. In recent years, we've had movies such as Mamma Mia, Into the Woods, Rock of Ages, Tick, Tick, Boom, and the revamping of West Side Story, just to name a few. And, you know, I haven't even listed any of the Disney movies there. So while we aren't in the golden age of musicals anymore, which I think La La Land is trying to play tribute to, musicals are still made and very much enjoyed. And while we're not really going to drill down too far into the conventions of a musical, one thing that they all do is to tell some of the story via the lyrics or the dancing. And La La Land does the same thing, which I think lends itself nicely to a study of subtext. Anyway, that's my little soapbox about musical movies. Valerie, what did you have for the genres?
Honestly, Melanie, I have the same thing that you do. I have a courtship love story that ends negatively, so it's a cautionary tale. In terms of secondary genre, I don't think there is one. However, I'm seeing the performance story for both Seb and Mia coupled with status story as a subplot. Why am I saying this? Because we're both sort of hovering around the same areas, but I'm sort of splitting things a little bit differently than you. How did I come to this? I did have to give this some thought because it was messing with my head a little bit. Okay. I think that in the main love story, there is not a secondary internal genre. Because in my opinion, neither of these characters changes. And that's why the love story doesn't work. That's why it ends negatively. Yes, absolutely. In the end, Mia's status rises. No doubt about that at all. And presumably so does Seb's, right? Because now he's a club owner. They're definitely in different places than they are at the beginning. No doubt about that. But as people, they haven't changed. Now think of Pride and Prejudice, right? Which is kind of the, you know, blueprint, if you want to use that word, for courtship romances. Both Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth have to change in order for that love story to work or in order for their love to last. So that's what I think about that. Melanie?
Yeah, it's a slightly problematic love story. But I think there's actually reasons in the movie as to why that's the case and maybe why they don't change as characters or the love story is not strong enough to change them, Mia and Seb, as characters. But I don't think I cover this, but I was thinking about that as I was listening to you talk about why you've put down a subplot as opposed to a secondary genre. And I probably agree with you. I did struggle a little bit to work that out. And so I agree with your assessment that it's more a subplot as opposed to a secondary genre. All right. So the director of this movie is, as Valerie mentioned, Damien Chazelle, who directed Whiplash, which we studied earlier in the season. Now, I didn't know this before watching the movie, which is interesting. So to do two movies by the same director in one season is good for me in terms of looking at how that particular director layers subtext into their stories. So I really enjoyed doing the contrast and comparison this last week while watching La La Land and thinking about Whiplash. And I do think Whiplash is a better movie, but anyway, moving on. Now, this movie surprised me with how much it relies on music, colour, and also silence to convey the story. And I think this means it's pretty rich in subtext, well, for most of the time. What I've come to realise is that subtext must have meaning in relation to the scene, the time, and the location of the movie. Because if you don't have that, then the subtext won't make any sense and it won't be realised. Now, there is a lot of subtext to digest in La La Land, so I'm going to hit the high points by topic this week. So as I mentioned, colour. So colour features really strongly in this movie, but I think there are times there when the colour is just there for effect and it doesn't seem to have the same level of meaning that we saw in some of the scenes in Whiplash. Although the overall tone of colour changes at the midpoint of the movie. So this is when the characters shift from the idealistic beginning of the story and their relationship moves into a more realistic and difficult part, then the colour becomes more muted. So the bright yellows, reds and blues are gone and there are more blacks, greys and darker colours in the scene setting and also in the clothes that the characters wear. However, in the what could have been sequence at the end, we see the return of the bright colours that we saw in the beginning, and the colours seem to support the two halves of the movie. And when we sort of see this idealistic imagining of the beginning of the movie come out in this what could have been scene. And when Mia then leaves the club at the end after the what could have been scene, we are left again with a realistic ending and not the idealistic one. So Mia is in black and she looks very sophisticated, whereas Seb is at the piano and sitting very much in the atmosphere and the decor of the club, which is very serious and probably typical of a jazz club. Now, the use of the spotlight becomes really apparent, I think, in the movie. So the spotlight is used regularly to focus on the central character or characters of a particular scene. Now, some examples include when Seb is performing by himself, when Mia tells her story to, or her aunt's story to the casting agents, and when she's standing on stage at the theatre looking for Seb at the beginning of the movie when they have their first date. It also focuses on Mia when she's dancing to Seb's music at the jazz club, and also when Mia hears their theme song at the end of the film, again sitting in Seb's jazz club. So the use of the spotlight directs our attention to two aspects of the story. So the first is when Mia and Seb are performing their art, and the second is at key moments in their relationship. So what I think is happening is where they are bringing the conflict between their artistic selves and who they are when they are in a relationship. And I think those two parts of the characters, it's not quite there, but I think it's very strongly suggested. And that is why I think the love story or the change doesn't happen, because we do see two parts of each character in conflict with themselves and with each other, and particularly when they're in a relationship. All right, roads and cars. So the movie opens on a gridlock highway, and this is where we also meet Mia, who's in a Prius, and Seb, who's in a 1982 Buick Riviera convertible. And as an aside, we never see Seb's car with the roof up, which reinforces the idea of another day in the sun, but I'll get to that in a minute. But they are vastly different cars. So Seb's desire to save old Jazz is reflected in his car choice, his style of shoes, and his clothes. And it's when he joins the band that some changes take place in his appearance. But it's mainly his clothes that are a reflection of that change. So the car is a representation of his unwillingness to change music styles and also to compromise. Now, Mia's Prius is more modern, and as per the scene when she asks Seb to get her keys, and there are nearly 20 Prius keys to choose from, Mia drives a car that everyone else drives, which makes it very difficult to stand out of the crowd, something Mia and her friends sing about when they get ready for their first party. Now, there are an amazing amount of scenes with Mia walking down a road, looking for her car, going to the cinema on a road, or walking with Seb when he visits her on the back lot. Now, roads are about travel and direction, and this links in nicely with the paths that both Mia and Seb need to take to achieve their dreams. I also think it's worth noting that the first time Seb picks Mia up from her house and they drive off together, he turns the wrong way down a one-way street. So that is a big sign that their relationship is not going to get them to where they'd like to be. Now, the relationships. Now, the ending of the movie is described as bittersweet because Seb and Mia do not end up together. However, I don't think it's a bittersweet ending because both have achieved their dreams and they have the life that they were hoping for at the beginning of the film. Now, the movie ends with Seb and Mia smiling at each other after the what could have been sequence, which is triggered by the refrain Seb plays on the piano. Now, this sequence is a Technicolor alternative universe, but I didn't leave the movie thinking either Mia or Seb were unhappy with their choice to pursue their art. In fact, they were both encouraging each other to pursue their dreams. So I think we have seen so many love stories with couples together at the ending that we forget what happens in real life. So not all relationships that end negatively, nor do they always leave the partners with bitter feelings. And this movie reminds us that there are some people who come into our lives for a purpose and they leave when their purpose is fulfilled. Now, the ending of La La Land provides us with a reality check about the messiness of choosing to pursue your art or your heart's desire and the sacrifices that it takes. This is real life, and it is a contrast with the nostalgic musical pieces at the start of the film. And I also think that while Mia and Seb were together, they couldn't move forward as much as they wanted to. The part of them that wanted to be in the relationship was in competition with the part of them that wanted to pursue their ambitions. And I think that this idea is supported as well in the movie using mirrors, reflections, and references to stars and sky. All right, so mirrors, reflections, duality, and the alternative self. So there are a few mirrors and reflections in La La Land. The first time we see Seb is in the rearview mirror of his car. And we also see Mia study herself in the mirror after her first unsuccessful audition. Now, both images represent the part of these characters chasing their dreams. These selves exist in mirrors because the reality for both characters is very different. So Seb is playing Christmas music and Mia is a barista. So both characters must maintain the dual parts of their lives. And we see Seb practicing and playing music, and we also see Mia auditioning for roles. And it's worth noting that when we see Mia audition in the first half of the movie, We also see a lot of other Mias, so other characters or other ambitious actresses who look very similar to her. And again, it comes back to how do you stand out from the crowd when so many other people look or appear the same way that you do? And in fact, when we first meet Mia, we see that she's on the phone with someone, or we think that she's on the phone with someone, but she's actually rehearsing. So we don't meet the real Mia straight away. We don't meet the one who's always trying to get roles to play someone else. So we see the duality of the life of an actor and the alternate self, the one that's always aspiring to get roles. And we also see the musician who has to play music he doesn't like in the hope of getting the gigs that he wants later. Now, the sky and stars are also reflected on floors and shiny surfaces during the dance scenes. So reaching for the sky and the stars is what both the characters are trying to do so that they can be successful. Now, Mia and Seb frequent places where the stars they admire either played or acted. Now, for Seb, it's the Van Beek bar that he mentions, and for Mia, it's the window from where Rick and Elsa looked out in the movie Casablanca. All right, on to the season and the weather. Now, the seasons are not representative of the weather in the movie, but the movie is broken into five parts, starting and ending with winter. And to be honest, breaking the film down into seasons was very confusing to me. I didn't see any evidence of seasons representing Mia or Seb's careers or the phases of their relationship. So winter shows us, or introduces us to the struggling Mia and Seb, and it ends when Seb knocks Mia after he's fired. Spring starts at the party where Seb is playing in the 80s cover band and ends with Mia and Seb kissing at the planetarium. Summer includes Mia writing and rehearsing her play and ends with her seeing Seb playing in the band The Messengers at the large concert. Fall or autumn starts with a fight about Seb selling out and playing music he doesn't like, and Mia deciding to remain in LA for her play instead of touring with him. It ends with Mia getting an audition that could see her filming in Paris. The next winter is 5 years later, where Mia is successful and is married with a child, and Seb has opened his jazz bar. So perhaps the movie could be broken down into spring and summer, when Mia and Seb are seemingly happy together, and winter and autumn, when they are not together or not in sync. Anyway, the weather, as per the opening musical piece, which is titled Another Day in the Sun, seems to remain bright and sunny throughout the film. There isn't any rain, nor are there clouds. And I think this is a deliberate reference to the dream of sunshine that LA offers to aspiring entertainers. Now, the music. Now, the music, or this movie, was really a homage to, you know, the musical movie, or the golden age of musical movies. The grand opening scene, the romantic back and forth tap dancing and waltzing, and the penultimate collage at the end took me right back to watching Saturday matinees on the TV when I was young. The only thing missing, I think, or one of the things missing, was the elaborate synchronized swimming sequence, which I used to love. I love those pieces. And I was glad that synchronized swimming was an Olympic sport. But anyway, I think I'm out there by myself on that. So if you listen to the music in the movie, you will hear how strings and woodwind instruments are used at key points to influence the emotions you should be feeling at the end of dance sequences, especially at the end of the romantic sequences. And despite all that mastery, my favourite musical section was when Seb is playing in the 80s cover band and Mia requests I Ran by Flock of Seagulls. And no, I didn't have to look up the band's name. I knew all the original band's names straight away. So there was also Soft Cell and Aha, if anyone was interested. But that's my favourite part of the movie, when she dances to him playing I Ran. Anyway, Finally, the title of the movie, If You Live in La La Land, it's basically a reference to not living in reality. Now, LA is described as La La Land, and as the center of the US movie industry, it's the place where dreams are made or shattered. The movie is a tribute to the glitzy and positive outcomes for the two protagonists, but it's also a reminder that not everything is as it appears, and success comes at a cost. Now, like I mentioned, there's a great deal of subtext in this movie, and I haven't covered it all, but what I hope I've shown you is how layered La La Land is. And if you study it over and over, you'll see how much detail there is and how the detail reinforces the themes and the message of the storyteller.
Well, I think La La Land is actually a great movie for us to study, even though we're speaking primarily to novelists on this show, although screenwriters as well. And this is a musical. So why on earth would I say that this is a good one for us to study? Well, because a lot of novelists, naturally enough, like when we're going up through school, we're taught that good writing is all about great descriptive paragraphs, right? And we're really focused on the pretty sentences. And that's important, yes. But it's not the first step. Like, you could have a whole novel filled with the most beautiful sentences ever written, and the book's the pits, because the story doesn't work. It doesn't work as a story. It's just a bunch of beautiful sentences together. So it's kind of putting the cart before the horse. And I think that La La Land does exactly that. So all of those things that you were talking about in your subtext section, I agree with them all. It is a visually beautiful piece of film. All these little fine touches are in there. 100%. But the story doesn't work. I applaud the musical. 100% applaud the musical. I love musicals. And even though I don't think Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are particularly good dancers or singers, and heaven only knows how much auto-tune was used, I still think that it's a valuable exercise to have big stars like this in this type of a film, because it's going to bring their audiences over to this genre. And just like I just saw The Music Man in New York, and you know, nobody was pretending that the audiences were there to see The Music Man. We were all there to see Hugh Jackman. He had us all charmed, but you know, he wasn't on stage 5 minutes when it was very clear that his co-star, Sutton Foster, was way better than he was. Better singer, better dancer, better at musical theater. But he's the showman. He is the greatest showman, right? And he is the music man, perfect casting. So I preface everything I'm about to say with that. Okay, so I am looking at middles, like the act two of stories this season. So let me give you the little act breakdown in case you're trying to learn how to figure out what act one, act two, and act three is of a story. So the way I've broken it down is this: the beginning is 22%, the middle is 55%, and the end is 23%. So the middle begins when it's just after that scene where Seb bangs into Emma as he's leaving the restaurant after he's gotten fired. Okay. So what about the story then? Well, honestly, there's actually not a lot of story here for me to talk about. But then again, thin storylines are common for musicals, but just like Melanie said, the songs are work because they are moving the story forward, because they're revealing something about the character, because they're something about the plot happens, because they're letting us know the internal struggle of a character. Something is happening in that song to move the story forward as a whole. Now, La La Land is sort of, the storyline of La La Land is even further diluted because it has two points of view. So there's, because of all the music that has to be in there and the dance numbers and the two points of view, Damien Chazelle hasn't left himself much room for the actual story. And I think that is the source of my frustration this week. So I love musicals, but the difference between a film version and a live version is that when you go to see live theater, whether it's a musical or a play, there's an energy in that room and it captivates the audience. In fact, it involves the audience physically in the story that's going on. And that energy can be very quickly lost on film. So even though La La Land is a beautiful film, I do like the music. The dancing is okay. Their singing is okay. The opening number that doesn't feature either of these two, I'm sure, very expensive actors, A-list actors, that opening number, the dancing on the highway, that's the best part of the whole film, in my not so humble opinion. Just like you, Melanie, I use the word homage. That's exactly what I think this is. But Ryan and Emma, as lovely as they are no Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So yeah, because these are thin storylines, there's not a lot for me to talk about, but there are a lot of story problems I can talk about. And I think they come because the story is so thin. I really do. Okay. So there's a couple of things happening here. And I'm focusing on act two, trying to stay on theme here. So these aren't in any particular order. One of the questions I have is, where did Greg come from? Like, we're led to believe that Mia is single, but then suddenly a boyfriend appears. It has not been set up at all. Greg hasn't been mentioned, and he didn't go with her to either of the two parties that we had already seen her at by the time he pops up. Now, why is this a problem? One, it's sort of destabilizing. We're like, what? Who's Greg? Because the roommate says, Greg's on the way, or Greg is here, or something like that. We're like, who? Who's Greg? But more grievously, it calls Mia's character into question. And it jeopardizes the empathy that the audience feels for her. Because if she is dating someone, it begs the question, why did she agree to go to the movie with Seb? So Greg is actually just a device here. He's here for this little bit and then he's gone. He's a complication that's dropped into the story just for one moment. And it's just to keep Mia from going to the movie. Now, because Greg is new to us, the fact that Mia is torn between staying at dinner with him and going to the movie with Seb, it doesn't ring true for us. This is the kind of scene that's usually at the end of a story, especially a musical, and we revel in it. We love it because we realize that the female lead has chosen to be with the man she really loves and the man that we want her to be with. So we are cheering her on and we're you know, we love these scenes. But here in La La Land, it happens really early in the second act. And it falls flat. Well, we don't care if she stays with Greg. Who's Greg? Right? So that image of Mia sort of running away on her toes, she's sort of like, you know, she almost looks like a Disney character, cartoon princess running away on her toes with her straight arms sort of out to her sides, running down the street, but kind of dancing down the street, almost touching the ground, but not quite touching the ground. You know what I mean? You've seen it in musicals, that sort of not quite real way of a woman moving, a very lyrical way of moving. And the scene is beautifully shot. It really is. And so she comes around the corner and she goes into the street and she runs off down the road. Well, who cares? It falls flat because we have no emotion. We have no emotional connection to that moment and that step that she's taking. So what this does is it puts the empathy with Mia at risk and we don't yet have empathy for Seb. So anyway, this movie reminds me a lot of West Side Story. I'm just going to warn y'all now. If you haven't heard our episode on West Side Story, go back and listen to it. This is the thorn that's in my side this week. Seb, even though he's played by Ryan Gosling, is not a catch. He just isn't. Now, yes, they cast Ryan Gosling. I mean, he's a big heartthrob. And just like in West Side Story, they took a character who is not attractive in personality, and they cast it with a handsome actor who has a big following in order to, well, here's subtext, Melanie, in order to make us think and make us buy into the fact that this is a great guy that the heroine should be with. So we judge this book by the cover, right? It's a good looking guy. We want her to be with the good looking guy, except that he's a jerk. He's a total jerk. He really is. And I tried Melanie this week, but I can't ignore what is very clearly here on the screen. So why do I say he's such a jerk? Well, first of all, let's talk about that car horn. Now, what is that about? It's obnoxious. It's just plain obnoxious. I think we're supposed to think that that's charming or something, or maybe quirky, or maybe he's a jazz musician, so I don't know, something about the sound. I don't know. I just think it's arrogant, and I think what he's doing is demanding that Mia come out to the car. He doesn't even have enough respect to go to the door and get her, or even sit in the car and text, "Here." No, he leans on the horn. Even the roommate says, like, "Are we gonna, is this always gonna happen?" And Mia, with this misty look in her eyes, says, "Oh, I think so. Really? Why is that acceptable?" It bothered me, especially in a story about music. Aha! Tell me what you think of this, Melanie. Because this is about music, and the music is beautiful in the story, and then we have this obnoxious car horn, could that be subtext to kind of indicate that this relationship might not go well? It's not harmonious. Am I out on a limb? What do you think?
I absolutely think that there will be some, I think that's on theme, right? So sound is important and music is important, and that car horn, the times when it does get used, is very abrasive. It is, you know, it does jolt you and is a good contrast to some of the lovelier sounds of the movie. So no, I think it's on theme. And it's also, I think, part of Seb's personality. So he is, you know, he's difficult. He's, you know, he's even says that his friend who has the band in the end says, you know, yes, you're a good piano player, but you're difficult. So he's known to be difficult. And I think the car horn just plays into his, I don't know, just the not so great parts of his personality, of which I think outweigh the good parts of his personality.
So this is an interesting choice then. I have to think it was a conscious choice because it's Damien Chazelle. But I also wonder, in the larger, you know, in the larger context of storytelling, given the setup of this very fantastic version of a love story, very romantic version of a love story, and the style of the golden era of musicals, is he trying to juxtapose that? Because, you know, Seb, in that setup, Seb should be like a Prince Charming kind of guy, right? Like a real catch. So I wonder if that is intentional, that he's jarring the two images, the old image and the audience's expectations versus what we get. I don't know. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is this whole issue of Seb taking the job with John Legend's band. I think it's supposed to be a proof of love. But, I mean, if it is, like, holy moly, it misses the mark. At no point does Mia ask Seb to get a steady job. She doesn't expect him to, and she does not need him to provide for her. He eavesdrops on her conversation, the one she's having with her mom on the phone. He doesn't talk to her about it. He makes an assumption He takes a job he hates, and then he turns around and blames Mia for it. This is really spiteful behavior. If a proof of love is a term that you've not heard before, this is in a love story. It's when one character does something selfless for the benefit of the other character, but without any expectation of having that act returned or even acknowledged. In my opinion, Seb taking that job is the complete opposite of a proof of love. How is the audience supposed to buy into any of the emotions expressed here, either the love or the regret or the remorse or the fighting? To me, it's not really that sad that in the end they go their separate ways to follow their dreams or careers. Seb taking the job was always about Seb. It was never about Mia, no matter what he claims. He may not be aware that it was about him, but it is. In fact, until he hears this conversation that Mia's having on the phone with her mother, and he hears Mia say that she assumes he's saving up money so that he can open the club, it doesn't even occur to him that he should be doing something to make his dream come true. Mia doesn't need Seb to look after her. And again, if this is an homage, maybe he's trying to turn it on its ear or something. But that was the kind of thing that happened in musicals from the Golden Age or any movie, really, years ago. But it shouldn't show up in a movie in 2016, right? This is the shift that we need to start seeing in stories, whether they're novels or films or television. We're not going to evolve as a society with stories like this being presented and sort of just taken whole without anyone thinking about it. So when Seb goes on tour with the band, Mia dutifully supports him. She only questions his time away when it's clear that there's no end in sight, because it's clear from their conversation that the initial assumption was that the touring would be for a set period of time. So she says, oh, you mean now it's just going to go on and on. But at the suggestion that she's going to have to go to Paris makes Seb end the relationship. So he has to go away for his work and she stays and supports him. But she has to go away for her work, so he breaks it off. It seems to be that Mia's independence is what causes the fight. Like, this is the thing that's not working in their relationship. Seb plays the martyr and claims that he joined the band for Mia. He wants recognition for his sacrifice, even though she didn't ask him to, even though she didn't even suggest that he do it. When she calls him out on it, he puts her down. He says, you're an actress. What are you talking about? And he says to her, maybe you liked me when I was on my ass because it made you feel better about yourself. Oh, come on. I mean, that's just childish and petty. Is this the love interest? Is this who we want our heroine to end up with? I don't think so. That's not a proof of love. It's manipulation, right? He's playing head games with her. So had Seb missed the band photo shoot and he hadn't said anything to Mia about it, that would have been a proof of love. He still had an opportunity to turn it around and salvage everything, right? Especially after the argument that they had over dinner, right? Where the smoke alarm goes off and then Mia runs out. Instead, he stays and does the photo shoot. He misses the whole performance. And when he realizes that it hasn't gone well and she is clearly distraught, so much so that she's saying she's giving up her dream entirely, he still doesn't do a proof of love. He says, I'll call you tomorrow. Now, I think these two live together. It looks like they do anyway at this point. So that tells me that he's going back to work. So even in her darkest moment, he will not put her ahead of him and ahead of his career. So then you might argue, okay, but he did tell her about that Amy Grant audition. He did, absolutely. I don't buy that as a proof of love. I think that's just common decency. And when he goes to her hometown and she says, no, I'm out, I'm not doing it, there are no words of support. He yells in her face and calls her a baby. Oi with the poodles already. This is enough, right? Oh God, I got another page and a half here in notes, but Melanie, like, I'm done. I'm so done with this story. It is so stupid. I can't handle it anymore. Like, I don't think that this is the stuff we want to put out in the zeitgeist anymore. I think there's enough of it. Damien Chazelle, in my opinion, could have done better, unless his goal was to somehow do some sort of fancy juxtaposition that has totally eluded me. Anyway, yes. Action step for today, Melanie.
Right. Okay. So this week I've highlighted a lot of visual subtext. So it's good to see in action, but we're writers and we need to use words. So this week, see if you can make up descriptive metaphors or sound metaphors for your story. You could also try writing taste, touch, and smell metaphors, which I think would be really helpful to give your text or your words texture. Anyway, that's my action step.
And that finally wraps it up for this week. Join us again next week when we discuss four weddings and a funeral. To support the show, please leave us a rating and review and tell your writer friends about us. For more than 70 hours of training and access to writing templates and worksheets, all for free, subscribe to my inner circle by visiting valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @Valerie_Francis. And if you'd like to find out about books to help you read like a writer, visit Melanie on Facebook and Instagram under Melanie Hill Author, or find out more about her at melaniehill.com.au. And remember, story theory doesn't have to be difficult. It's a tool to help you write more, not less. So take it one step at a time and have fun.